This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We are talking about the new paid sick leave program. We are talking to Rocco Rossi, and I'd like to bring in Dr. Naheed Dosani, who is a palliative care physician and a health justice activist. Hi, Dr. Dosani.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. What don't you like about this program?
I think one of the first things we have to recognize is that paid sick days have evidence to work. We have evidence from the states that in influenza, cases went down by 40%. During COVID-19, we've seen cases go down by 50%. But what we've also seen is that this plan was not the best paid sick days plan in North America, not even close. It offered 3 days in a pandemic where people need a minimum of 10 to isolate. It's like giving 3 days of antibiotics when a prescription really calls for 10 days.
Uh-huh. Isn't it better than what we had before?
You know, it's better. You know, 3 days is better than nothing. But why should we be settling for better than nothing? Our patients need at least 10 days and another 14 during public health emergencies. We've been calling essential workers, quote unquote, heroes. And it's very clear that this government values the labor of essential workers, but not their lives. The argument for paid sick days that are legislated and employer paid is not exotic. 16 states in the United States have permanent legislated employer paid sick days. Not to mention that the fact that this announcement announced a plan that wasn't seamless in addition to not being adequate.
Well, I guess what they're saying is that after the 3 days, the federal program, which they want to top up, would kick in.
And like many things, the devil is in the details. The reality is you can say that and it sounds nice, but it's not actually that seamless for the person or the worker. This really creates a Band-Aid on a Band-Aid problem. And the truth is that once workers are up with their 3 days, they have to apply to CRSP, and that's not as seamless as it sounds. It has the same problems as before. Workers are already dealing with a broken vaccine system. You've heard about the Hunger Games of vaccines, but now not only are workers left struggling to book vaccines, but now need to go through the same mess to access paid sick days. It's just not fair.
Rocco, is your take on the federal program the same?
Look, we know you don't have to have a subjective opinion about it. The federal government notionally set aside $5 billion for sick benefit because it knew, as anyone could tell them, that this was going to be a big issue. There has been now the newest estimate is that less than $750 million will be taken up for two reasons. One, that the doctor has said it requires an application process, which is after the fact, so it leaves a gap for people. And if you're an employee that has to make the choice between doing the right thing by public health and putting food on the table, having that gap is not helpful. Number two, it was limited to $500 a week, which is essentially a little bit above minimum wage. And so to be fair to the provincial government, the offer to top up to several weeks, double to $1,000, all programs need two things. One, they need money. And two, they need a mechanism to deliver that money. And I totally agree with the doctor that the mechanism that's being suggested is not as efficient, not as useful as it could be. It's going to be better than where we were yesterday. So let's not let perfection get in the way of better than where we were. But we need to keep pushing, as we have on lots of programs throughout the crisis. When wage subsidy started, it was 10%. It didn't move the dial. People weren't picking it up. It had to be adjusted to 75%. The rent subsidy program initially, the offload of the management to it to landlords, not appropriate, very low pickup. It after months of fighting, got changed to tenant initiated, far better pickup. We don't have months. I share the doctor's sense of urgency. So we need all levels of government at the table. The money has now been set there. It's a matter of having the willingness to have the appropriate mechanism. And as I suggested, there are tools available. Because of employee remittances, you could simply subtract from that and deal with the paperwork at the back end. The employee wouldn't need to see that at all, wouldn't be affected by that at all. And businesses would have the certainty that the money is there and not have to wait for months on end to be reimbursed. We all agree with the initial statement by the doctor that this is a key tool in helping us to manage the outbreak, particularly that we've seen of this third wave with more virulent variants that are affecting younger people. And those who are most at risk are those who have to be at work in person every day in crowded settings. And so we need this. We need more in the way of targeted vaccines. We need rapid testing. There's a whole suite of things, and together we can push for it. What will kill it is to try to inject a permanent solution in the middle of a crisis that we don't share in common. Let's deal with the crisis. Let's deal with it now as efficiently, effectively as possible, because it's a real problem that has to be addressed.
Let us take a call from Dennis in Brampton. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Libby. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. I'm having some difficulty understanding why the government is expected to pick up the entire tab. Does this mean that large employers, and I understand smaller business would have difficulty paying paid sick days, but are we going to be, in effect, subsidizing large employees? And I'll throw in Amazon, Walmart, and Loblaws as examples, and I'm sure there are many others, who are already making on the pandemic. So
they're making profits. You're cutting out. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. My understanding is that Amazon has covered some of this. I don't know.
I'll jump in on this one. I really do agree with this caller. Thank you so much for bringing up this point. By reimbursing employers for this expense, workers through their tax dollars, we the taxpayers are ending up subsidizing profitable corporations who can totally afford to pay for paid sick days. Jeff Bezos has gotten $91 billion richer, the founder of Amazon, during this pandemic. And so Amazon can certainly afford to pay for its own paid sick days. And that's why we have been asking for employer-paid, legislated paid sick days. Time and time again, we have seen this government support.
Okay, one at a time.
And big box stores who are interested in profit. This is once again seeing that happen. And you know, quite frankly, as a health worker, I'm sick and tired of seeing my patients get sick and die as a result of these policies.
Okay, Rocco, can you jump in? Because my understanding is that some of those places are paying for sick days.
They are, and the program explicitly will not compensate those who already have pre-existing sick days, either through collective agreement or because the margins of their business have allowed that to be negotiated before this time. But the second point, and this is really the crucial one, because people want to pick an individual company to demonize. I have 60,000 members in Ontario. 59,999 of them are not Amazon. Tens of thousands of businesses have gone bankrupt during this crisis. Tens of thousands more are hanging on by their fingernails. These are businesses that people need to survive in order to have jobs going forward. And the last thing they need in the middle of this is to be legislated an additional cost. And this is not an ideological issue. The Premier of British Columbia, Premier Horgan, who heads a majority NDP government, understands the math and has not legislated employer-paid sick days either before or during this crisis. So let's be clear here. those who make additional profit are going to be taxed. That is the mechanism that we have in our society. We didn't set a means test for CERB up front for individuals. We just said, look, those who are getting it who didn't really need it are going to be taxed at the back end. What we should be looking for is the quickest, most efficient system to move forward in the middle of a crisis, and then we'll come back to what permanent things are required in a non-crisis circumstance. But let's not confuse the two, and let's not affect the vast majority of businesses and employers by trying to categorize them in the same breath as very large, very profitable businesses, because the vast majority of businesses, the vast majority of the employees are working for businesses who are not in that position.
We are almost out of time, so I'm going to give the last word to Dr. Dosani, about 30 seconds, please.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think we did get 3 days on paid sick days. It's better than nothing, but we shouldn't have to settle for, you know, the 3 days that we got. This is like giving people 3 days of antibiotics when the prescription calls for 10. It's literally minimum 10 days of isolation. The CRSP federal program is not seamless. We need a program that's seamless, fully and employer paid, universal, adequate, and permanent. Essential workers are our heroes. Their paid sick leave should not have an expiry date on September 25th. We need permanent paid sick days in this province.
Okay. Thank you both for your views and for clarifying the situation. It's a start, the 3 paid sick days. Thanks so much, Rocco Rossi and Dr. Naheed Dosani.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.
Okay. I'm told I say okay too much. I have to watch that. So Free for All Friday is coming up tomorrow. I've had a lot of tweets from people who say, oh, you wouldn't have taken my call. I absolutely would have. So please call in with your thoughts. Tomorrow's the day we deal with whatever you want to talk about, not just the topics that we here pick. Looking forward to it. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. After months of pressure, yesterday the Ford government announced a paid sick leave program. It offers workers 3 days where their pay will continue as usual, up to $200 a day. And employers will be reimbursed. After that, they'd have to apply for the much criticized federal program. Queen's Park is working with Ottawa to top up those benefits, so they would double from $500 to $1,000 a week for up to 4 weeks. That deal is not yet done. Mayor Patrick Brown of Brampton has been pushing for paid sick days. He joins me now. Hi, Mayor Brown. How are you?
Afternoon. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you so much. Always good to talk to you. So what's your reaction to what the government is offering?
Well, I want to start off by saying it's progress. This is something we've been pushing for a long time. 25% of COVID-19 cases in Peel through our contact tracing are linked back to individuals going into work sick. And so this was a tool that our medical officer health thought was critical. So I'm encouraged that they've made this announcement. Listen, I know no announcement is going to be perfect. There are always going to be critics, but they put a lot on the table here. And it's a $2 billion provincial commitment. The 3 days are going to help. The enhancement of the federal benefit is going to help. So I would say I'm encouraged. I know some people will say, you know, why isn't it 14 days? You know, it's still an important tool that we didn't have before. So I believe this will help.
You're right. And we will be talking to at least one of the critics. So a lot of critics saying it's not good enough. But there's also a criticism that maybe it's kind of too late. I mean, this thing is not passed yet. The federal provincial piece of it, I mean, that's not even agreed to. So what about the timing? Is it sort of too little too late?
Listen, I wish that we had it 6 months ago. I think it would have helped curb the escalation of cases. Clearly, if 25% of our cases have been traced back to people going into work sick, I don't think there was initially an appreciation for how vulnerable some essential workers are in terms of living paycheck to paycheck and not being able to miss a paycheck, because if they did, they wouldn't be able to put food on the table or pay their rent. But, you know, I have to acknowledge it's still going to help. You know, we're not out of this yet. We're going to have a tough next month, at least, likely tough few months, and this will be a tool that will help. So I'm grateful. You know, it doesn't help anyone to look backwards and criticize. As a mayor, I just try to look forward and get whatever tool I can to help our residents, and this is a tool that's going to help.
I remember talking to you a few weeks ago and asking you what the reason was that they were so resistant to this, and I basically, you said they didn't want to spend the money. What do you think finally changed their minds?
You know, I think there was a chorus of input from the medical officers of health, from leading physicians, and I think it started to have traction. You know, I can tell you, I had a number of conversations with the premier, with the finance minister Peter Bethlenfalvy, and I know I was explaining to them how the federal benefit wasn't working. I think at the beginning they really believed the federal benefit was a good stopgap, but it was an effective measure. I explained that it was below minimum wage; it would take sometimes 3 months to get back. What I like about the benefit they've introduced right now is that the employer will be paid back, but the employer will provide those paid sick days. And so it means there's going to be a continuous paycheck. The programs you have to apply for and wait months, they don't work for people living paycheck to paycheck. And so I like the element that they've removed that uncertainty and that paperwork in the process.
Now, what they have been saying lately is that the federal program has been fixed or expedited and that most of those checks now arrive 3 to 5 days. Do you have any sense of whether that is true?
Yeah, so I haven't heard that. One of the number one complaints that I heard in Brampton was how long it would take to get those checks back. I'm told they're trying to improve it. I certainly haven't heard any cases of it coming in 3 to 5 days. It's about that ability to have the continuous paycheck. And the reason people are apprehensive about trusting some program in Ottawa is they didn't want the rent to bounce. They didn't want to not have money in their bank account to pay for groceries. And so I think over the last few months, there's been a greater recognition that there are many essential workers in incredibly vulnerable positions. And I think that realization has helped the government adopt a course that they probably weren't going to adopt otherwise.
What about the criticism that the application process itself is a barrier, especially if people are sick? Because, you know, you have the 3 days, but if you need more time, you have to get busy and apply for this federal program.
Yeah, and so one of my misgivings with the federal program is that it's paperwork. There's a lot of red tape in doing so, and there's a lot of people who simply can't navigate that federal bureaucracy and where to apply and how to do it. And it's why I think the 3 days is significant, because it's easy. The employer ensures the paycheck continues. They're the ones that have to do the paperwork. I would love it if the federal system was the same way. So listen, it's not perfect, but we have progress. And I'm always someone that acknowledges progress, and I think the government has made progress on this file that is going to be helpful.
What about the vaccine rollout and the new pharmacies going in? Do you feel that things have improved and that Brampton is getting more of a fair shake?
So at the beginning of the pandemic, we were around 6% of the provincial vaccine allocation, and we had 10.5% of the population. It moved to 9%, then to 10%. They're telling us that our May allocation is going to be 13%. So we're heading in the right direction. The science table has said that we should allocate 50% to hotspots. If there was a 50% hotspots allocation of hotspots, we'd probably be at 20%. And that would make an immeasurable difference. You know, we still have a lot of essential workers that can't get vaccinated. The average age of an essential worker is 36. The age threshold at the mass vaccination centers is 45. So, you know, we still have some distance to go before we can get to our most vulnerable workers. And I get emails and calls every day from loved ones of essential workers pleading, saying, when are we going to, you know, I'm worried about my son or daughter or my husband or wife going into work each day. When are they going to be eligible? And so for me, that's still hard to hear because I want them vaccinated yesterday. But I do acknowledge the trajectory is encouraging. We going from 6% to 13%, we're starting to see more of a focus on hotspots, which is helpful, but we could go further.
You know, there's one thing that is extremely encouraging because going into this, there was so much concern and still about vaccine hesitancy and the theory that it would be prevalent or more prevalent in ethnic communities like you have in Brampton. And as far as I can see, people are clamoring for those shots. They are not hesitant.
Yeah, they are clamoring for those shots. You know, we have significant interest. What will be interesting is as we get through more of the population. So right now we've got about 30% of the population vaccinated. And we need to get to 70% to have herd immunity. And so once we get through all the age thresholds, that's when we'll find out whether there is any vaccine hesitancy. And we're already working on a public relations campaign targeted to the various cultural communities that is the mosaic of Canada and our community. So we're going to have an effective effort to make sure we push back against vaccine hesitancy.
Okay. Anything you want to leave us with?
No, just stay safe and all the best. Things continue to be crazy in my household, two under two.
Yeah.
So my wife gave me permission to sneak away and do this interview because you can't say no to you.
Okay.
That's good. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right. First, before we get to the next, I'm going to take a call from Clay, who has been waiting very patiently. Hi, Clay.
Hi, how are you, Libby?
Fine. How are you?
Not bad. I tell people to take a marking pen and take accountability out of the dictionary and take compliance out. You know, they're calling for Mary Fullerton's resignation. They should be calling for the resignation of the 75 inspectors. I mean, the ones at the end were doing their inspections over the phone, which is garbage as well as, you know, as well as I am. That's crazy. I'm a survivor of Johns Manville, and I think I've mentioned before, Libby, the Ministry of Labor had phoned on Monday, say we're coming out Thursday for an inspection, so obviously everything that was of concern was shut down. I feel sorry for Doug Ford because he's getting the brunt of it. He's made a lot of bad decisions. He's trying to please too many people. But you know what? Kathleen Wynne, if you remember, they had the big fire at Lake Megantic, Quebec, and all the nursing homes, they need sprinkler systems. And she gave the long-term care homes 15 years. Why didn't she give them interest-free loans to do it now instead of waiting for 15 years? Like, I mean, there's so many fingers to be pointed at so many people. It's terrible. I feel sorry for these people in long-term care.
Yeah, certainly there is plenty of blame to go around. Clay, thanks very much for your call.
Bye.
Bye. Okay. There is a lot of criticism of the plan for paid sick days, especially from doctors who end up treating infected essential workers and their families. And what about the businesses that will have to cover those 3 days and put in whatever paperwork is needed to get the money back? Let's go to Rocco Rossi, President and CEO of the Ontario Chamber of Commerce. Hey, Rocco.
Hey, Libby. Thanks for shining a light on this.
Okay, so what's your reaction?
Well, I do think there are some positive elements to it. I like the fact that the government's acknowledged that at a time when so many businesses are hanging on by their fingernails, it shouldn't be business paid. It'd be paid out of general government revenues. The point that you raise is an important one. We want to make sure that the mechanism of the reimbursement is fast, and WSIB may not turn out to be the best way to do that. But it's still very positive. We've been calling for some time at the OCC of the importance of paid sick days as a key measure, a key tool to help us manage this crisis until we have that herd immunity that Mayor Brown talked about earlier. So it is crucial. We've seen in this third wave that there are these hotspots. There are disproportionately essential frontline workers are being affected, and so paid sick leave so that people do not have to make the choice between doing the right thing by public health for all of us and versus putting food on the table. The big piece that needs to still be sorted out, and I think would truly make it a fabulous program, is really the top-up that the province has promised on the federal program, because then that gets you into several weeks, not just 3 days of coverage. And that's the piece that's got to be made seamless, because that will respond in the best possible way. But to those who say, well, you know, not enough, what I would say is it's better than where we were yesterday. What we need to do is get it to a point where it does the job that it's intended to do, which is really take that horrible choice off the table for employees.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take a break in a minute. Just, one point. First of all, I don't see how that's going to become seamless. And you mentioned off the top that maybe the Workplace Safety and Insurance Board is not the mechanism for a quick refund. I mean, aren't they notorious for bureaucracy?
Well, there is new leadership. We'll see. Look, I believe, as with all things that have been happening during the pandemic, the proof will be in the pudding. So they have to show it to us. But a faster way of making it seamless, one suggestion that we've made is, you know, employers have to pay employee remittances back to both levels of government on taxes and other things. And if you simply said, look, you could subtract from the remittances what you're paying in the sick benefits, and then we'll sort the paperwork out at the end, that would get the money immediately. That would not create this lag, and it would help to make seamless between the 3 days into the federal program, so that there's real coverage for employees facing this crisis.
That sounds like a good idea. Maybe it makes too much sense. We have to take a break. Rocco, please hang on. On the other side of the break, we'll have more with Rocco Rossi and also a physician critic of the plan, Dr. Naheed Dosani. And I will take some of your calls, I promise, on the other side of the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. Yesterday, the Auditor General released a scathing report on the state of long-term care and the sector's inability to protect residents when the pandemic struck. It was the latest in a very long line of reports, which have largely been ignored by successive governments over a period of decades. The report, though, did find that lax inspections and the Ford government's slow response worsened the situation. But here's how long-term care minister Marilee Fullerton sees her role.
It's kind of like running into a building, a burning building. You know, you're trying to save it and you're doing your very best. But the fire had started well beyond the pandemic. And so I think it's our government that is a government that is committed to this.
Well, you know, it's really interesting how people see themselves and what they're doing. If anything, I'd say it's more like closing the barn door after the horses have escaped. Now, the Auditor General herself issued this report with a caveat that none of it should come as a surprise. So what does Bonnie Lissick hope will come of her work and the recommendations attached to it? She joins me now. Hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So first of all, the minister clearly thinks that none of this is her or her government's fault. What do you make of that?
You know, I think you have to look at the particular issues in terms of responding to that. I mean, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the recommendations from the past with respect to infection prevention and control that came out of the SARS Commission, the expert commission there, the changes that were needed so that when a pandemic hit the province, that the impact of it was managed and that, that there were systems in place that could deal with it effectively. So with respect to that, we know that infection prevention control in the long-term care homes was not where it needed to be when the pandemic hit. And that being the case, the cases spread quite quickly. The compounding of that was the systemic issues in terms of, you know, having more than two people in a room, having three or four. We know that a lot of the homes that were impacted during COVID had three or four residents in the room. And as such, when people were moved into the long-term care homes and the capacity was already high, that caused, that gave the homes the inability to isolate people within the home. So the systemic issue did contribute to that. There were things that happened during COVID that maybe contributed a little bit more to the confusion and to the outcomes. And that would have been at the time when the system is broken, more direct guidance is needed. The homes needed to have very, very clear guidance as to how to deal with the pandemic, from public health and from the hospitals and from the chief medical officer of health. There's a combined issues that led to what we saw.
Well, I can see that you don't want to point the finger at them, but it's this government that got rid of a lot of inspections. And during the pandemic, such as they were conducted mm-hmm. on the phone.
Now, I think on the inspection side, it's fair to say that what happened there is at the end of 2018, a decision was made to stop comprehensive inspections by the ministry to go ahead and deal with the backlog of complaints and incidences. So the focus was on that, such that the comprehensive inspections, you're right, were stopped. And those inspections were the only ones that were identifying that there were infection prevention control weaknesses in the homes. And so now a lot of these homes had those issues raised for many years, and the follow-up process on making sure that they fixed those issues wasn't in place. So we do have recommendations in the report around strengthening the inspection process, getting the public health unit involved in the inspection of IPAC and strengthening the ministry inspection process. But you're correct to say that the full inspections did stop and there was a refocus of attention on the inspections. And that did happen at the tail end of 2018, beginning of 2019.
And the infection control, as you pointed out, that was talked about after SARS, which was the Liberal government, but the Ford government did nothing to enforce that either.
Yeah, and I think, you know, under the legislation, the Long-Term Care Act, the main responsibility for having plans in place around infection prevention control and teaching staff how to deal with it is with the operators of those long-term care homes. Now, when there is a system as big as the one in Ontario, there needs to be an acknowledgement by the ministry and by the public health system that they would require education and they would require more help in making sure that they have access to the correct information to implement good IPAC directives in their own homes. So in that sense, there still needs to be more work in working with the long-term care homes to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future, even after COVID. Because we see in the third wave, vaccinations have worked. Our hope in putting out this report is that the eyes are not taken off the long-term care sector just because COVID passes and they're not getting as infected. There's other issues that need to be addressed.
Did you deal at all with the second wave? So, for instance, we knew about these infection control problems mm-hmm. in the first mm-hmm. wave. There was right. this lovely respite that we had to prepare for the second wave, which everyone knew was yeah. coming. In places like Quebec, they made sure that there was an infection control person, officer, whatever, somebody in charge of it in each home. This province did not do that, and the result was that the death toll in the second wave was even more devastating.
Yeah, I think we saw the first wave. It was sort of a wave up and down. It happened very quickly, and you'd expect at the front end that there'd be more surprises. But by the time we hit the second wave was longer and flatter. And what we saw when we looked at the data is that there were different homes impacted, and there still was not enough relationships in place to help those homes between the hospitals and the public health. And there still was, the issue of PSWs was still an issue, you know, the turnover and people not showing up, as well as not letting people go in to help their loved ones. The intent was there so that, you know, the COVID spread would not happen from visitors. But I think that there needed to be the acknowledgement that sometimes those family members are also the people that feed people, that dress them. And that having not having that there put an additional strain on those long-term care homes. So there is that aspect that we recommend needs to be reviewed, as well as the ability to move people out of the long-term care homes to areas that they can quarantine people in and having that facility set up. So even though one would say it's the long-term care home's responsibilities to deal with something like this and have a pandemic plan, two things were working against them. They didn't know where to look to, you know, get quarantining done. And they didn't have a requirement under the regulation in Ontario to have such a plan in place. And so both of those things needed to happen before the second wave as well, like a quick, setup in terms of relationships
so
and
that,
accommodation.
Again, this is a failing on the part of the government.
I would say that there needed to be things put in place that could deal with what we saw happening in the first phase, in the second phase, perhaps quicker. That we're basically commenting on our report to that effect. What we're basically saying as well is that no matter, you know, what we've seen in the first wave, second wave, still keep the eyes on the long-term care sector. We're obviously not positioned to have a fourth wave in the homes, but the plan should be put in place to avoid any type of situation like this happening in the future. And so there's lessons to be learned for everyone. And quick decision-making. I think one of the things that came out of SARS was the principle of precautionary principle. And what does that mean? It just means making decisions, and it's not always dependent on the science giving you 100% the answer, right?
A couple of notes on your comments about essential caregivers. I remember while we were in the thick of it, there were umpteen experts saying the same thing, that you're punishing people. We had examples of people deteriorating terribly, which you put in your report, but no one listened. No one listened until, it was all almost over. So that's one thing. And what about an enforcement piece? I mean, this is something that goes back a very long time. So even when we know that there are deficiencies in the home, nothing happens. And the argument seems to be, well, if we shut them down or whatever, then where will those people go?
No, I think you've hit the issue on the head. I think there's been a lot of tolerance and a lot of patience and a lot of, sort of paper, processes to say, you're not doing this, clean it up, instead of a more stronger enforcement. And so we have, as an office, been recommending that be looked at. Because even when we did the original audit and long-term care inspection process in 2015, we recognized that there wasn't enough being done to make sure that the homes came through and fixed what was being identified as weaknesses. There are, in our report, we talked to a number of homes that have had repeat orders that they needed to fix their infection prevention control processes. The biggest one is plans of care. The biggest one that we see is that the plans of care for people residing in those homes needs a lot more attention, a lot more inspection, and a lot more enforcement if those plans of cares aren't being followed properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all, going back, we all, the cases of terrible bed sores. So as you said, no surprises here. This report, your report, comes after a very, very long list of other reports whose recommendations have been ignored. So what are your hopes for this, and how do you plan to make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, we're pulling together in that report a lot of information from a lot of different sources, and we've put in the report 16 recommendations, but there's 55 actions attached to those. We've had the responses that there is intent to implement, so we will be following up on those. I think, there will still be the Long-Term Care Commission report coming out. I can't see how we wouldn't be aligned. There's a lot of things that likely, you know, are consistent as well. So my hope is that between, you know, the reporting that's coming out that has recommendations in it, that those recommendations will be worked on, and that everyone keeps their eyes on making sure that there are positive changes made to the long-term care system as part of an integrated health system as well, not as a second cousin to the healthcare system.
A couple more questions. First of all, do you have any kind of number attached to the fixes that you want to see happen? And where's that money coming from?
Already we have seen that there has been commitment to renovating some of the rooms in the long-term care so that, you know, they become one and two bedroom rooms. So we see that. And BC has less 3 and 4 person rooms in Ontario, which is why the first round it affected them less. We do see there are initiatives for looking at the PSW staffing. That's a huge issue. 61% of the employees in long-term care homes are PSWs. They have a hugely high turnover rate. 40% leave a job in 1 year. So, and that's a profession that's not regulated or wasn't tracked.
They've announced some new regulation of it yesterday.
Yeah, and that'll be good because, to make it more of a profession, because we're, you know, when you think of it, the province regulates like real estate agents, but here are people that are dealing with our important seniors that, you know, built up the country. So we do see hope in that. And obviously there are recommendations that come at a cost, but there are also recommendations that can be implemented just with the people that are currently doing their jobs and just doing the jobs differently, right? And roles and responsibilities between public health and long-term care being clarified as well.
Okay, very quick question just to end up. Yesterday, we found out about an emergency order where people can now be moved from hospitals to long-term care without their consent. Does that worry you?
I think, you know, I don't know the details behind that, but, you know, hopefully the details that were considered making that decision took into account the occupancy in the long-term care system in the retirement homes, and that it can afford having people moved from the hospitals to those facilities so that, you know, we don't see the consequences that we saw when that was done before. The vaccinations play into that as well. So, you know, I think in the initial wave, they thought the hospitals would be overwhelmed and I think recognized it was the long-term care homes. This time the hospitals are being overwhelmed. So as long as the occupancy is taken into account and the seniors are protected with vaccination, you know, that might be a way to free up the hospital. So, but, you know, obviously I haven't seen the data. I'm just hoping that that's what the decisions were based on.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bonnie Lissick, Auditor General of Ontario. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thank you, Libby. Bye.
Oh, bye. So how do stakeholders see this? Let's bring in Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association, and Jane Midas, staff lawyer and the institutional advocate at the Advocacy Centre for the Elderly. Hello.
Good afternoon, Libby.
So let's begin with Jane. What is your reaction to the report and what you just heard Bonnie Lissick saying?
Well, I mean, you know, the reaction to the report is that it's, you know, nothing new, as she said. You know, these are all things that were problems and, you know, continue to be problems in long-term care. And I don't see that it's going to change. I'm very disappointed in the minister's response to this and her, you know, seeming lack of understanding of what the government's role was in this. I think you said something about keeping the door closed after the, you know, in the barn. Mine is, I think that, yes, it was on fire, and then they came in and threw gasoline on it because they stopped the inspections. They forced people, you know, they were pushing people into long-term care. They didn't take proper steps. They didn't have any plans going in. They didn't have any plans in the summer. And, you know, they didn't even have the long-term care sector at the table initially. And I think this just goes to show, you know, exactly what the ministry, what the government's opinion is. It's, you know, and we're seeing it now with these new forced transfers to long-term care homes and retirement homes, which are not long-term care homes and which will have no oversight. I mean, it's just, it's incredibly insane.
And no medical or almost no medical, you know, no medical care in them.
That's, yeah. And you know, it's another tragedy just, you know, on the brink. I'm just terrified.
Before we move on to Donna Jane, so the fact that really Minister Fullerton just, I don't know if she's blind or she's telling herself this to make herself feel better, how this lack of accepting responsibility for any part of what happened, you know, what's the upshot of that?
Well, I mean, you can't fix what you don't think is broken. So if she thinks that she did a great job, then, you know, the government's not going to change what they were doing. And, you know, throughout this, you know, she's had very specific positions, for example, around the inspections when, you know, consistently they were being asked about, why aren't they doing full inspections? And she kept saying, well, but we're doing critical incident and complaint inspections. Well, you know, as the Auditor General's report pointed out, in which we in the system know, they're not the same thing. They don't look at the same things and they don't find the same things. And so she doesn't think she did anything wrong. So it can't be fixed.
Okay, let's bring in Donna Duncan. Donna, what's your view of this report? No surprises. And the way the minister reacted to it.
Yeah, you know, I echo Jane's comments and the Auditor General's comments. No surprises. We knew that we were facing a perfect storm before this hit. And we knew that, you know, we've had decades of neglect of a system. And quite honestly, I would say that we all failed our seniors. And not just in Ontario, but across Canada and globally, we've seen this virus really prey on our most vulnerable citizens. You know, I have to say I do give the government some credit for starting to move on some things. I would say that we have new relationships. They prioritized us for vaccines. They did start to build out IPAC over the summer. Was it enough? Absolutely not. Was there some progress? Probably progress that benefits us more today than before. And we have seen absolute tragic loss of life. And we can't lose sight of the fact these are human beings. And we've got to all retain our empathy and compassion for the people who've died, for their families, but also for those frontline staff who've just been traumatized through this. I think going through the report of the Auditor General, looking at, you know, she validates that the staffing crisis that we continue to be in, those old homes and those buildings. And we're excited because we actually have a home opening this weekend. So that's progress, and we'll take that. And we'll take the new relationships that we have with hospitals for IPAC, but also for wraparound. And we've been working with Ontario Health and the government around how are we going to respond to this extraordinary new order around transfers into long-term care. And, you know, we're hopeful that it will be done respectfully and safely, and that there will be individuals who are moved into long-term care will have services and supports wrapped around them, including medical supports, psychogeriatric support.
Let me just ask you, with that, do the homes have control? Like, can a home say, I don't have room for anyone extra, or the hospitals say, okay, you're getting Mrs. Jones tomorrow?
Yes, the homes do. And we do have commitments that they will consider geography, they will consider culture and faith to make sure that there are appropriate placements in those regards. The homes also can say, we don't have enough staff. So if you're going to move someone here, you have to make sure that we have nursing staff, that we have medical supports, and potentially also psychogeriatric supports for some of these placements. So those commitments have been made to the sector that this will be a partnership and that this is a tool that will only be used in extraordinary circumstances. And really the focus is on voluntary transfers into homes in partnership with the patients who will transition into becoming residents and their families.
My understanding was that they want to move 1,500 people.
That was the original target in terms of moving in across the province and moving beds. We've had, I think, as of today, close to 600 people who've been transitioned from hospital into long-term care. The focus really is going to be on those geographic hotspots, including the GTA, really prioritizing that transfers in this community where we have the greatest pressure on the hospital ICUs.
Okay. We're basically out of time on this. Jane Midas, 20 seconds to wrap up, please.
Well, just on sort of this last thing we were talking about, the transfers and into the homes, I'm not sure if the ministry and the government has thought this through. I think that there's a lot of implications in this that they may not have thought of, such as, who's going to pay for the transfers. I just read today that, someone who died in a hospital out of town is being forced to, pay coming back. And this has always been a problem. And who's paying for that? If they're coming back to a home, it could be thousands of dollars if they have to come by a orange ambulance if the government hasn't paid for it. I think there's just a lot of things that they really haven't thought of, including the fact that if they're using these beds in retirement homes, and the government's paying for them, they're no longer under the Retirement Homes Act, therefore they're not going to be inspected.
Wow. We were talking about that yesterday. We'll be talking about all of this again next week. In the meantime, thank you so much, Jane Midas and Donna Duncan.
Thanks, Lee.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, Mayor Patrick Brown, he's been pushing for paid sick days for months, and we finally got some yesterday. We'll find out what he thinks about the program and whether it will help the situation in Brampton, which is very hard hit, on the other side of the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.